Session this morning is on basic principles of counseling. In the description of how to build into the lives of men, we often break it down into, first of all, sharing your life with a man, sharing the word and prayer. Another aspect is problem solving. Because if you're going to build into a man's life, you can't build on a weak foundation. You can't build on debris. And if a man's got something that's really eating on him, or it's a problem, whether it be in home, at home, or his personal life, or in the lives of some of his loved ones, if he's preoccupied with this, you really have a difficult time in building gold, silver, and precious stones into a life that's on a shaky foundation. And so then you have other aspects of giving your life to men, sharing your ministry, and so forth. But this problem solving is the sort of thing that we're talking about in this session on counseling. In a sense, it's really man-to-man. And it's a deep aspect of man-to-man because it's heart-to-heart. And what we want to talk about this morning is how to effectively be able to get inside a man's heart and to get him to share what it is that's really bothering him, or to allow him to get this out. First of all, we'll be discussing the need of counseling. What's the need? And secondly, what is the objective? What are we trying to do when we counsel men? Thirdly, what is the atmosphere in which counseling can best be done? And then fourthly, I just called it the procedure, or principles to keep in mind when counseling. So the need, the objective, the atmosphere, and the procedure. And the passage of Scripture that came to my mind on this matter of the need was Matthew 9:36. But when Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them, because they fainted. The footnote here says they were tired and lay down. They were disheartened, their heart was gone, and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. And I don't know about you men, but if most people are like I am, very seldom does a day go by but what something comes into my life that really kind of tests me and weighs me down. And there's nothing that helps. Of course, prayer is our main asset of being able to go to the Lord and cast all of our care upon Him. But boy, it's immeasurable, the benefit of having a buddy, someone you can go to and just bare your heart. And most people that I run into, usually deep down inside, you say, "Well, how are things going?" And their first response is, "Fine." But you know, deep down inside, when you get heart to heart, there's something usually that's really eating on them. One day here at Glen Eyrie about 6 years ago, Bob Foster and I met on the road, and he said, "Well, Jim, how are you?" And I said, "Bob, I'm fine, great." And all of a sudden, I looked up into those cold black eyes. I mean, warm black eyes. But they were piercing right through me with just a faint smile on his face. And he said, "Really?" And man, I felt like he could see right through me. But he, you know, he was always getting these pat answers of, "Well, things are fine." But he wanted to know, how are things really down inside? And so it seems here that most people would like to have a shepherd or someone who could help them. They could bear their heart to them. Proverbs 11:14 says that where there is no counsel, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. And then the promise of 2 Timothy 1:7 that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And this could lead us right into the objective of counseling, helping people to escape the spirit of fear, but have power and of love and of a sound mind. When Doss Trotman first started the ministry of the Navigators, there were three men that he used to go to for counsel: Charlie Fuller and a couple of other men. But he observed that all three of the men to whom he went for counsel were men who were men way up in their late 40s and 50s. And he asked the Lord, he said, "God, make me a counselor of young men early in life. And I think God really answered that in Doss's life. Because as a young man, in his life, men were coming to him for counsel. And the Lord could work in our lives in such a way as to early make us able to give objective, godly counsel to people who have problems. Now, last summer at our staff conference, Tommy was there and Elvin and Ken. We had a speaker here by the name of Wendell Grout. And Wendell gave a message one day on the art of counseling. And he shared with it the objective of counseling are threefold. And so I just used his threefold objectives for counseling. And one is to discover the person's problem. That's what we're trying to do. And just as a parenthesis on that, you might want to add that we don't want to deal with the symptoms. Often when a person comes to you, they share the symptoms, but they themselves are not really able to lay their finger on the real problem. And so our objective is to discover what the real problem is. Then secondly, it's to help that person discover his own problem. Because if you discover my problem and you just hand it down, I may admit to it or say assent to it, but I haven't really gotten the first step of getting the solution because I myself have not been able to define the problem. So help the person discover his own problem. And then thirdly, and this is the important thing, help him appropriate Christ for his problem. It was thrilling to me one day in reflecting on Isaiah 9:6, one of the names of Christ. For unto us a child is born, for unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor. Someone has said that in the Hebrew that comma need not be there. That it's not two names, Wonderful Counselor, but Wonderful Counselor. So in a sense, we ought to think of ourselves as we sit down with men to counsel them as not our having all the answers, but just our being a channel, an earthly tabernacle for in which God is dwelling, and God is the one who's going to give counsel to this man. Jeremiah 23:16 says, "Hearken not unto the words of the prophets that prophesy unto you. They speak a vision of their own heart and not out of the mouth of the Lord." And I don't know about you guys, but in just what little counseling I do, I find out that men really don't want to know what Jim White has to say, but they really want to know what God thinks about the situation. So counseling is to help them appropriate Christ. And Colossians 2:9-10 says that, "For in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and you are complete in him." I was talking with Dr. Bob Bremner this morning about a problem back in the area that I felt that I wasn't equipped to handle. It was a problem that dealt with a long series of incidences in a man's past, which had created a pattern of thinking in his life, an abnormal sexual response. And I wanted to know if I should send him to a Christian psychiatrist. And Bob Bremner says, "Well, I've dealt with a number of these cases, and I'm convinced that it's a moral problem." And he said, "I believe that the blood of Jesus Christ is sufficient for that problem." And he gave some illustrations of how he had seen God really heal in a situation like this. And so if we can have in mind that Jesus Christ is sufficient, and that somewhere in the Word of God there's an answer for this person's problem. Why don't I just real quickly go through some thoughts that I have written down here to stimulate our discussion, and then let's come back and you guys can put stars by any of these thoughts, and we won't take time to elaborate on a lot of them, but allow you to respond to these, and then we'll open discussion. But on the atmosphere of counseling, I had five thoughts down here. Number one, the atmosphere should be relaxed and informal. We never like to sit behind a desk or in any way elevate ourselves above the person, but to be a buddy. Often if you can go out for a Coke or sit down, prop your feet up or something, but a very relaxed, informal atmosphere for counseling will more than likely get the person to feel like freedom to share. Then secondly, give complete attention to the person and his problem. And someone commented that Billy Graham is the epitome of being able to do this. That when Billy Graham is talking with a person, that person gets the impression that he's the only person in the world that Billy's interested in. He's just glued to that situation. And a couple of years ago, I was riding along with a fellow who had once lived in my home. And I asked him if he had any suggestions for me. And he said, "Well, Jim," he said, "often when I sat with you in your living room and I was trying to get a problem out and share my heart with you, if one of your children came into the room, you immediately switched your attention from me to your child." And I went on to discuss the situation with him and explained why I did that, that I didn't want my children to think that the ministry was taking me away from them. And so, but what I did learn from him was that I shouldn't be doing my counseling in my home where my little kids were. So that it wasn't that it was wrong to give the attention to the kids, but it was wrong for me to do my counseling in the home. Because I wasn't able to give this person my full attention because I was so conscious of this child wanting my attention, you see. So we need to be able to give our full attention. And to the person and the problem. Then thirdly, don't get professional. Be a man of humility, a man of God, a man of the Word and prayer. And the whole atmosphere of our counseling should be one of dependence upon God. Dick Halverson, pastor of Fourth Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., said that early in his ministry at the Hollywood Presbyterian Church, he found that he was just being swamped by couples coming to him with problems in their marital life. And he said, "Early I just determined that I didn't have all the answers, but I knew who did. And if I couldn't give the person the answer to their problems, I could point them to one who did have the answer." And so our atmosphere for counseling should not be one of know-it-all, that I have all the answers. In fact, sometimes it's so refreshing to share a problem with somebody and the person say, "Buddy, I'm really sorry. I don't know what to do in this case, but I know who does. So let's go to our knees and pray." And then fourthly, the atmosphere should be one of confidence. A person is not going to come to us if they feel we don't have good judgment and know how to keep a tight lip. Sometimes a person will come to me and say, "I'd like to give you something in confidence. Would you promise you won't share it?" And what I have to say to a person in a situation like that, because so many facts come into our are brought to our attention when you're in the Christian ministry, that sometimes it's hard to remember what was given to you in confidence and what wasn't. And so often what I have to tell a person is that, "Well, if you share this with me, what you'll have to do is just trust my judgment and my discernment to know how to use the information." Because sometimes there is an occasion in which it's necessary to share something. But it would only be in the case where it would be for the person's good. And if we're not men who know how to keep a tight lip and not go around sharing with people who don't need that information, before long, people won't be coming to us. And So we need to be men who know how to keep a tight lip and not blurt out information that's been given to us when somebody shares their heart with us. And then fifthly, in this atmosphere for counseling, it may be that we need to humble ourselves and let that person into our hearts, identify in order to prime the problem. I remember sitting in the living room of my home in Lincoln, Nebraska about 6 years ago, and we had some men sitting around the floor, and I had a feeling that many of these guys had a certain problem. And so that night, as I sat there on the couch, I said, "Well, fellas, you know, I don't know if you guys ever have a problem with this particular thing in your life, but boy, I tell you, there's times when this has really bugged me." And I just shared a few thoughts on it, and I mean just like popcorn, their hands started going up. "Jim, I've got the same problem." But you know, for months, they had never come out with that because they were afraid they'd be rejected. And so as sort of the counselor, so to speak, when I identified and shared my heart on the situation, immediately they opened the door of their life, and then we had a heart-to-heart talk. So if you sense when a person comes to you, if they're kind of slow in coming out with the problem, it may be that kind of getting down on the human level, getting off of the throne or the pedestal on which this person has you, and get down as a sinner with them. Often when you identify, they'll just immediately begin to share their hearts with you. And then on the procedure for counseling, I have discovered that when a person comes to me with a problem, that often the first problem that they share is not the real problem that they want to talk about. But they're kind of feeling us out to see what our response is to that problem and to see if we're going to show shock or if we're going to understand. And so often when a person comes, that first problem is just kind of the shock troops. It's just, they're just coming in to kind of see what the reaction is, but the real problem will come up later. And so the principle is just be sure you wait for the real problem. We don't need to open our mouths and start turning out the pat answers and spend all the time dealing with this first problem when that may not be the real problem at all. And then secondly, I just wrote down here, listen, listen, listen. Proverb 18:13 says, "He that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame to him." And Wendell Grout gave the illustration this summer that a man came to him with a problem and shared his problem with Wendell Grout, and Wendell just sat there and listened. And this went on for about, was it 2 hours, Smitty? Or over 2 hours, this man just went on and on and on sharing, and Wendell just nodded his head, and ever so often would just kind of ask a question to clarify something, but the guy just kept going on. And at the end of 2.5 hours, the guy got up and he said, "Pastor Grouch, you'll never know how much your counsel has helped me." And really, what the person wanted, see, he discovered his own problem by talking it out. But sometimes, if we're not careful, a subtlety will creep in, and we want unconsciously to be the instrument of handing down the answer of God to this person, when really the best thing in the world that can happen to them is if they discover their own problem. And often they just want to talk. In fact, someone was telling me the other day that somewhere in the world there's a place where they have booths with machines, and you can go in and put a quarter in it and talk into the machine. You can just talk out your problems and then go away. And they discovered that in itself has a therapeutic value, just to talk into a machine. But how much more effective just to be able to come face to face with a man of God and just to talk, talk, talk. So one principle that we should remember is try to listen, listen, listen. Someone pointed out that Job spoke one chapter in the beginning of Job, and his friends spoke four. Poor counselors. Then thirdly, ask questions. learn to ask questions to bring out the pertinent facts on the situation. And at this point, I just made a note that you may, by asking certain questions with a new person who's come to you with a problem, you may want to find out if they really are a Christian. The whole problem may surround the fact they don't have assurance, or they may not have ever really accepted Christ. And there are certain of these basic foundational things that we need to know about to know where they stand in their Christian life. So learn to ask questions. And then I just made a footnote here on this third point. I think we need to be careful not to probe too deeply, too quickly. I don't know about you guys, but I've found that if a person comes to me and I begin to probe too fast and I bring out the real problem and it's really messy or it's really, they're so ashamed of the situation, that person may go away and never want to face me again. Because we haven't really established that buddyship, that friendship that communicates to him that, buddy, I accept you and I love you no matter what you've done. And so if the person goes away without that confidence, they get home and say, good night, what did I share with him? Oh, I should have never done that. And then they begin to avoid this. And so we could probably do well to learn to ask questions, but be careful that we don't get too intimate too quickly. Let it come out in its own time. And remember that problems are not always solved in the first session together when you talk with a guy. You may have to wait until they really feel that they can come out with the real problem. Then point four under the procedure I just jotted down here, avoid taking notes. When we're talking with people about intimate problems, something is kind of, they get kind of jittery if they see you writing down this very confidential information. They'd like to think that it goes into this storeroom here and stays shut tight behind a locked door. But now if I feel that I need to sort out the problem after I've left the person, I might jot down some pertinent facts just to keep myself reminded of the basic salient facts of the situation. But there's something that when I talk to a guy, if I come to Elvin and share my heart on something, it'd bother me if he were sitting there. Now, what did that last point, or what did you feel your real problem was saying? So avoid taking notes. And then fifth, attempt to find out the cause of the problem. When you feel you've begun to lay our finger on the real problem, let's try to find out, let's don't treat symptoms, but try to find out what caused that problem. And there could be four different causes in basic categories. One is spiritual. And I have certain questions that I ask a person about their devotional life, their witnessing, their obedience, to kind of find out if there's one of the spokes of the wheel that's being neglected in their life. And I, almost without exception, when the person's problem is spiritual, you can trace it back to a breach of one of the four spokes of the wheel. A girl came to me in a college up in the Northeast last year, and she was really having problems getting close to God. God wasn't real to her. And in the midst of the conversation, this was the last time I was going to see her. I was leaving this college campus, and so I maybe probed a little deeper than I would have with a person the first time, and I asked her, I said, I forget what her name was, but I said, do you feel that there's anything in your life that has happened that you've never really ever shared with anybody that's kind of eating on you? And there was a long pause, and then tears began to stream down her face, and she bit her lip, and she said, yes. And then she just began to share how she'd been bitter against her mother for years and years and years, the way her mother had treated her and neglected her. And she'd never shared this with anybody. It just outwardly, she pretended to love her mother, but inwardly there was this just eating on her, see? And so bitterness being a sin and resentment was just eating away her spiritual life, and no wonder God wasn't real to her. But until we can get to the cause of the problem, we really can't deal with it. So it could be spiritual. It could be physical. Leroy Iams one time out in the Midwest, he thought he had a demon. He just, man, all kinds of oppression coming in on him. And he went to a doctor and found out that he was just physically shot. He was run down. He was emaciated. And he began to do calisthenics and get himself physically built back up. And the problems left. So it could be the cause of a problem would be physical. And maybe we can come back to this if this is of any interest to any of you guys later. But the problem could be emotional. See, there are certain basic temperament types. Some people are kind of melancholic. Others are, you know, they're insensitive leaders. They're choleric. Others are kind of easygoing. And others are kind of sanguine. Life is just one great big bowl of cherries, you know. To the melancholic, life is just one great big bowl of cherry pits. You know, well, and so sometimes I have to realize in my own life that some of my problems stem to the fact that I have a big dose of melancholic in my life, and that I'm overly sensitive about some things, you see. So helping a person kind of understand their basic God-given makeup often helps them see why the devil is using certain things in their life to prod them when they needn't do that. They could just tell the devil to get behind them. And then fourthly, attempting to find the cause of the problem, it could be mental. And there may be some problems in which we need to send the person to a Christian doctor. And point six under procedure, don't show shock. Dr. Bob Thieme of the Baraka Church in Houston once said, don't ever be surprised at anything you see in the life of a Christian who's out of fellowship with God. Boy, you can see anything. But if you come to me with a problem and you share it and I say, really? Boy, that's the end of that one. You begin to kind of put a beautiful halo over the thing and try to get out of it some way. But when a person shares something that's really deep, to communicate acceptance, confidence, love, this is what we need to do. Then seven, watch for certain signals. Like if a person overstates something, they're really just going on and on and on about how wonderful something is, the chances are that underneath the actual reaction is just the opposite. A pastor in Pittsburgh was telling me that a woman came to him with a problem, and she was just telling how wonderful her husband was. And he kept asking her, and boy, just how wonderful. Her husband was such a wonderful man. He was so competent. He was so considerate and all this. And the pastor began to catch this signal that she was making too much of how wonderful her husband was. And he just stopped her and he said, you know, how do you really feel about your husband? And she turned and clenched her fist and gritted her teeth and she said, I hate him. The facts were, he was a man with a PhD. She had never been, just barely out of high school, and he browbeat her all the time, and he had actually convinced her that he was perfect and that she was just the scum of the earth. And she looked up to him because he was so competent and everything, but inwardly she just resented him. See, well, sometimes if a person comes and makes too much to do about something, it could be that they really don't feel that way about something. Another signal that I look for is if a person is just trying to escape their problem, but they're not really willing to surrender to the will of God. And if that has not been dealt with, if that surrender is not there, you can't go any further, really. They're just trying to escape the problem. And then I wrote down here, number eight under procedure, use the word and prayer for solutions. People don't need a shortcut by an experience with the Holy Spirit or something like that. They just need faith and obedience. Faith in the promises. And sometimes I just have to tell a person that Well, you know, what you need to do is just brace up and go and confess to this person. You've done something to offend. You've sinned against this person. What you need to do is just go and say, I have sinned. But bringing the light of the Word of God to bear on the person's problem and using the Word and prayer as the solution is a big point. And then, 9, let God do the chastising. I've seen in some situations in my own life and the lives of others that we kind of take it upon ourselves to do the chastising if a person's sinned against God. And that's not our prerogative. God has all kinds of ways of getting a person squared away. God does the chastising. And then because this is a session of all men, I just put in this 10th point. I found in my life that I need to avoid long sessions with women. In fact, I've kind of put it down as a point in my mind that when I'm counseling with a woman, I want to kind of limit it to 45 minutes at the very most. And then maybe later on for another 45 minutes. But I just heard from other Christian leaders that women really appreciate and they really like and desire and crave the attention of men. And sometimes they can just go into all kinds of details just unconsciously trying to prolong this time of counseling with a man. And so when and if it's necessary, it's best for women to counsel women and men to counsel men. But when you have to counsel a woman, I like to limit it to a few minutes. And then two other thoughts under this matter of counseling women is, if at all possible, and usually it is, rarely is the exception, do it in a semi-private type situation. Not behind a closed door, but in a place where you can be seen but not heard. I've often thought that if I had to be in a situation where I had to counsel a lot of women, I'd want to have a door with a glass in it, and to where my wife or anybody else passing by could see in there, see. But I've talked with Christian counselors that said back in their early days that they would be counseling a woman and she'd begin to cry and before long she'd be holding his hand. And boy, that can get devastating. And just another note under this is just don't touch a woman. Avoid long sessions, avoid private situations, avoid touching. When I first start out, I want to find out, well, what are you doing? Kind of get their home background and find out kind of how they came to this situation today. And how they met Christ. That's the sort of question. How'd you become a Christian? And often I'll kind of go back and find out, well, how'd you get into this job? Do all you guys know, have you heard of Dick Halverson? Dick often... He just has his congregation just right in his hand. And one of his secrets, one of the methods that he employs is he really shares his heart with his congregation. Many a time I've heard him stand and point out his mistakes, his failures, his heartaches, his disappointments. And he was speaking to a group of ministers in Boston one time in which they asked how they could keep fresh in the ministry and keep from growing stale in the Christian work. And he shared this as a principle of let men get inside your heart. And I went up to Dick one time, Johnny Sackett and I did, and we were talking with him, and he was giving us this illustration of this talk in Boston with these pastors. And he said, you know, guys, there's an outstanding Presbyterian pastor in one of the large cities of the United States, a man with whom I am very close, but we disagree radically at this point as to whether or not you can really share your heart with men and keep their respect. And he says to me, Dick, you can't do that. You can't let people know what you're really like and keep their respect. And I say, well, I do it. And then Dick said, he said, we see each other about every year or two, and every time we get together, this thing comes up as to whether or not you can get heart to heart with men. And he said, the other day, this man came to me. His son is a sophomore in college. And he told me, he said, Dick, you know, you may be right. He said, the other day, my boy, who's a sophomore in college, was home, and he's been a real discipline problem to us. And we were standing in the living room, and I had just really raked him over for something that he had done. And he said, my boy stood in front of me with his fist clenched and his jaw tight and his face red with rage. And he said, Dad, you've never been wrong, have you? And he said, Dick, he said, I'd been wrong lots of times, but he said, I had never admitted it to my boy. And he knew I'd been wrong. And he resented the fact that I had never admitted it. And he said, Dick, you may be right. But this matter of being human, and to what extent, there probably is a point of discretion as to how much you share and with whom you share. What are the guidelines on this? I have encouraged fellows who sometimes have come with a deep, intimate problem. I have often told them, now, I feel that you've made the big step in solving this problem in the fact that you're willing to get it out and admit it. But I really don't feel it's necessary for you to go around to everybody sharing this thing, the fact that you've got it out to one person. Or if it's a confession, it's only due to the person against whom you've sinned. You don't have to go around telling everybody. And every time when we get together with guys, we don't have to sit around and see who can tell the biggest sin or share the most gory stories. That really is not edifying at all. And there are some movements in Christian history that have gotten off on this of sitting around seeing who can tell the dirtiest confession, you know, who can tell the worst sin in their lives. And so I'd say that what was said here about being discreet, that if you sense that a person has a certain problem and you want to kind of toss out to identify, that would be good. But D.L. Moody once said, beware of the man who tells you everything that he knows the first time he meets you.